Let me read to you the passage of scripture we're going to be focusing on in this, our last message in the Generous series. It's from Luke chapter 19. You can go ahead and turn there in your Bibles, or you can follow on the screen or in your bulletin, or if you've got a smart device with you, you can download our app and follow along there, and if you do that, you can take notes with everything that we say, and you can also, there's questions at the back end of that in the app where you can follow and do those questions and be ready for your small group later this week. So Luke chapter 19, hopefully you are there by now. We're going to start right in verse 1, and we're going to read through the story of Zacchaeus. This is how it begins. Jesus entered Jericho and was passing through. A man was there by the name of Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was wealthy. He wanted to see who Jesus was, but because he was short, he could not see over the crowd. So he ran ahead and he climbed a sycamore tree to see him, since Jesus was coming that way. When Jesus reached the spot, he looked up and said to him, "Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house today." So he came down at once and welcomed him gladly. All the people saw this and began to mutter, "Jesus is gone to be the guest of a sinner." But Zacchaeus stood up and said to the Lord, "Look, Lord, here and now I give half of my possessions to the poor. And if I've cheated anybody out of anything, I will pay back four times the amount." And Jesus said to him, "Today salvation has come to this house, because this man too is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek and save the lost." So Father, as we dig into your word this morning, I pray that you would speak to our hearts and teach us something. Lord, change us, I pray, in your name. Amen. Jonathan Last wrote an essay for the Weekly Standard a couple years ago. And in it, he said how he was once a man of power and dignity, with control over his life, until the day he became a father. And then he shared how one afternoon, just a few weeks into fatherhood, he was changing his infant son when all of a sudden his little boy began to pee. And not just a little trickle, he began to pee a geyser, a jet stream geyser of pee. And he, the father, took pride in the fact that his reflexes, his gut reflexes, were to throw himself in the stream of the pee, to keep it from spraying all over the wall and the bookcase and everything that was there. And he was standing there blocking that stream of pee, proud of himself that he was being peed on because he had reacted so quickly. And then he began to wonder, wait a minute, where did this impulse come from to thrust myself in front of the stream of pee? Where did a week ago, 2 weeks ago, I was a man of control over my life, and now I'm jumping in front of streams of pee. What happened to me? Where did my dignity go? And this is what he wrote. He said, "This is about when I started to realize that the primary effect of children is to take things from you. It begins with sleep and time and dignity, and then expands over the years to include serenity, sanity, and a great deal of money. I'm making an observation here," he writes, "not complaining. It's just what they do. And I'm not going to lie to you. In fatherhood, there is much, so much to be lost, but there is so much to be gained too. A father who is radically generous gives up sleep and time and dignity and power and serenity and sanity and a great deal of money to raise up his children. And that's a good example for us as we strive to become radically generous ourselves. Over these last 6 weeks, we've been talking about what it means to be radically generous. And radical generosity will cost us, we've said, in all the currencies of life. People who are generous to the core, they give of their time, their talents, their energy, their emotional energy, their relational energy. They give of their forgiveness, their love, their money, and their power. And in our passage today, we come across a man who, when he met Jesus, was transformed and became generous not only with his money, but also with his power. And this morning, we're going to talk about the effect of encountering Jesus, what effect that has on us, and how he makes us generous with our power. So let's set the scene for this story so we make sure we're there and we recognize what's happening. We're in Israel about 30 years after the beginning of first century AD. The Roman Empire is fast rising and taking over the world, and they're very smart about the way they do it. When they take over, when they defeat a nation, they don't wipe them out and plunder them. They leave their economy intact. It's like moving into someone's house, taking over their home, but you let them keep going to work every day. You don't kill them. No, you let them keep working every day. And then what you do is you tax them. And we use the word tax loosely because what the Romans were really doing was extorting them. Their soldiers were there protecting them. It's the original Italian mafia here, right? And then what they would do is took 80% of all the income for themselves and left the nations they took over to subsist on, you know, meager 20%. And they were really genius about manipulating people because what they did is they took certain people. So in this case, Israel, they took certain Israelites and they put them in charge of certain things. They put them in charge of collecting the tax and being part of this so that enough of that nation was invested in Rome doing well that they would keep the status quo. And it only took a certain number of the population. And Zacchaeus was one of those people who was helping Rome to keep the status quo in Israel. He was not just a tax collector. He was a chief tax collector. He was in charge of the other tax collectors in the town of Jericho. Jericho was a major city on the way into Jerusalem. So all kinds of traffic came through that town, which meant they collected a lot of taxes. And what most of them did is they charged more than they were supposed to, because the Romans didn't care if they charged above what they wanted as long as they kept collecting the tax. So Zacchaeus had become extremely wealthy, had an incredible amount of political power. And here's this man with all this wealth and all this power. And in the end of our story, he does a complete 180. And instead of amassing wealth and power and grabbing for it, he begins to give wealth and power away. And here's why. And if you only remember one thing this morning, remember these words. Meeting Jesus converts you. Meeting Jesus converts you. Meeting Jesus revolutionizes you. You don't just get a little bit of Jesus. You don't just become a little bit Christian. If you've truly met Jesus, then you will be transformed. It's not about merely getting some information or some inspiration for your life. It's about conversion. And today we're going to discover four things about this encounter, or from this encounter Zacchaeus had with Jesus. We're going to look at the necessity of conversion, how our lives must change. We're going to look at the circumstances of conversion, the fertile soil in which conversion takes place, the kind of soil we need to be for genuine conversion to happen in our lives. Then three, the key to conversion, what it is at the core. And then the last thing we're going to look at today is the sign of conversion, the evidence that you and I are truly being and have been converted. So let's look at the first one, the necessity of conversion, okay? I've been listening to an audio version of Dale Carnegie's classic bestseller, How to Win Friends and Influence People. Anybody here ever read that book? Usually a lot of people have. Okay, so there's a book recommendation for all of you. It has been around forever, sold a kajillion copies. Everyone reads it, and there's all these testimonies about how it revolutionized their lives and how they interact with other people. So I've been listening to that, and Christina overheard it the other day, and after listening to it for a few minutes with me, she summed it up by saying, oh, so just be nice. I'm like, yep, here's this book that sold billions of copies, and yeah, it's true, just be nice. And if you listen to him, and she said he sounds Christian. It sounds like he's a Christian because the things he's saying are the things that are talked about in church every week, from the time you're a little kid to the time you're old. And many, many people believe that church is all about helping people to just be nicer. It would be so easy to grow up in a Christian home and go to church every week and think that the whole point is to just be nice. Just be nice, would you? Jesus was nice. You be nice. But listen to what C.S. Lewis wrote about that in another great book. So I'm going to send you home today with two books to go read. One is How to Win Friends and Influence People. But before that one, read C.S. Lewis' book, Mere Christianity, and let it challenge you in your understanding of faith. So here's what he writes about being nice. He says, "But we must not suppose that even if we succeeded in making everyone nice, we should have saved their souls. A world of nice people, content in their own niceness, looking no further, turned away from God, would be just as desperately in need of salvation as a miserable world, and might even be more difficult to save. For mere improvement is not redemption, though redemption always improves people, even here and now, and will, in the end, improve them to a degree we cannot even imagine. God became man to turn creatures into sons, not simply to produce better men of the old kind, but to produce a new kind of man. It's not like teaching a horse to jump better and better, but like turning a horse into a winged creature. Jesus Christ has not come to make us nice. He came to make us new." Look at what Jesus did that day in Zacchaeus' house. Look at verse 9 and 10. What does Jesus say there? He says, "Today salvation has come to this house, for the Son of Man came to seek and save the lost." Jesus isn't talking about a small adjustment, some new idea or way of thinking. He's talking about an encounter with God. Salvation has shown up in this house today. The Son of Man, the Messiah, God himself, has shown up here. Dads, what was it like when your baby was first born? You remember? Can you remember what it was like? How did your house change that first night, that first week, month? How has it changed since that day? It was revolution, wasn't it? Everything changes. Everything's different. All the relationships are different. The house is different. Everything changes. And that's the change Jesus is talking about. When he says salvation has come, the word he uses for that is the word for birth and creation and new existence. He's saying salvation has been born in this house today. A new life has come to this house today. Nothing's ever going to be the same. It can't be. It has to be different. And that's what Jesus came to do. He did not come to alter your life and my life a little bit. He did not come to make you and me better versions of ourselves. He didn't come to make you your best you ever. He came to find lost people, lost creatures, and turn them into sons and daughters. This past week, a woman was kidnapped in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Some guys showed up, it was a former boyfriend, choked her unconscious, threw her into the back of a van, chained her there, duct taped her face and her neck, and drove off. Thankfully, some of her neighbors saw it happening and called the police. But it still took 12 hours for them to track down the van and rescue her. Thankfully, they rescued her. And as they brought her out of that van, she was saying to them how she thought her life was over. She thought she'd lost everything and she was dead. Can you just imagine how she felt when she saw the police open that door and as they set her free from those chains? What if the police had just said, "Oh, you look hungry, you want some burgers?" and gave her a hamburger? Or just said, "Oh, you need some clothes, let's give you some clothes." Or just said, "Oh, you don't look comfortable, come here, let's put you in a seat in this van." And what if they had just done that and said, "Okay, now carry on, have a good night," and then walked away? She needed to be saved. She needed conversion from prisoner in a chain to free woman back home. And that's the kind of conversion Jesus came to bring us, to take us from bound up with our lives forfeit, prisoners to a twisted and broken world, and to set us free. Not to just change a few things, but or rearrange our schedules so church now gets included in our lives. Not just to make us nicer people. Jesus didn't come to make us nice. He came to make us new. We need conversion. Have you been converted? Are you being converted? Experiencing this new birth, this life inside of you that Jesus came to bring? More than just going to church and being nice. A new life. Conversion is necessary. But then what are the circumstances of conversion? Under what conditions is real and true and deep and lasting conversion most likely to take place? Does it have to be a desperate moment like this woman being saved from her kidnappers? So we have this idea that a person has to reach the end of their rope in order to really turn around and be saved, right? Sometimes we say that. Oh, they just have to become desperate enough, and then they'll finally turn to Jesus, and then they'll get saved. There are times in my life I've even prayed, God, do something in their life to make them really desperate. Like, make their life miserable, so then they'll turn and they'll follow you and listen to you. And just look at the way people flock to churches after tragedies like 9/11 or Katrina. You know, it just seems natural. Yeah, I need something tragic, something desperate, because when I'm desperate enough, then I'm more likely to be converted. But have you ever seen someone who thinks they're drowning and how they behave? When I was a young teenager, I took some lifeguard training classes, swim training, how to rescue people. And one of the first things they taught us is if you see someone that thinks they're drowning, what are they doing? They're like, right? They're flailing around. And they said, stay away from them. I'm like, wait a minute, this is a save them class, right? And they're like, no, stay away from them. Let them tire themselves out a little bit. And then once they're tired out, then approach them carefully. Otherwise, they will knock you out. They will drag you down. A person who is desperate is out of control, and they will grab and cling to anything. That's what we do when we're desperate. I'll grab to anything that I think might save me from the moment of desperation that I'm in. I don't care what it is. And I've seen a lot of people turn to Jesus in moments of desperation and then turn right back away when that moment of desperation passed. So the circumstances of genuine and lasting conversion have to be something more than mere desperation, right? And look at our passage today. Look at Zacchaeus. He's not in a desperate situation. He is more than comfortable. He is set for life, has anything he wants. But he wants to encounter Jesus. He's curious. But he has a problem. He's really short. And that's what people think the problem is. But that's not really the bigger problem here, right? Let's look at it closely. The problem isn't so much that he's short. There's a crowd there around Jesus. And here's this powerful man, powerful, wealthy man, who probably had bodyguards traveling with him. But somehow he isn't able to get through the crowd of people to get close to Jesus. Why not? Why won't they let him through? Because they hate him. It's not that he's short. And that's part of it. That's why he can't see from outside the crowd. But why can't he get through the crowd? He can't get through the crowd because they hate his guts. Because he's a traitor. He betrayed his entire nation. He betrayed God as far as they're concerned. They hate him and they don't let him in. So he's got this problem. He wants to see Jesus. What does he do? I want you, okay, picture this. Picture this short man, very wealthy and distinguished and good-looking and dressed well in opulent robes, and he's trying to see, and he can't, and so he takes off running down the road, right? Men in that day didn't run. Runs down, embarrasses himself, runs down the road, and then he's wearing a robe. How many of you climb trees in dresses? There's a reason you don't do that, right? He shimmies up this sycamore tree. Grown man, wealthy man, dressed nicely, is willing to go through all kinds of indignity to persist in order to see Jesus because he is curious and he is persistent. That should be a clue to us right there. He is curious and he is persistent. And that's when he encounters Jesus. You see, when you're desperate, you're not curious. You're just desperate. I'm not going to investigate anything. I'm just going to grab it because this will help me. You're not investigating. You're trying to survive. You're focused intensely on yourself when you're desperate. And when you're desperate, you're not persistent. You grab at anything. Have you ever seen someone who has to go to the bathroom really bad and they can't find the bathroom and they're just trying every door and every door is locked and they just, what do? They don't stand at the same door trying it until someone lets them into the bathroom. They just keep trying doors. You just keep trying anything, and you don't pause and wait. You're not persistent because you're desperate. Desperation doesn't let you be persistent. Desperation, that's not the best circumstance for real conversion. Now, please understand me. I am not telling you that you should not share the gospel with a desperate person. That is not what we should take away from this. We should, but what I am saying is this. Do not wait until a person becomes desperate and think, oh, they need to be desperate before I can share the gospel with them. Because that's not true. And then some of you, maybe some of you are sitting here and you've been thinking, well, you know, One day I'll really experience this conversion thing and really experience this transformation thing. But you know, I guess I just need to get desperate enough first. And you're waiting for that moment to come when you're desperate enough. And then you'll really begin to pursue Jesus. Life will really get tough, and then you'll really, it's not going to happen. Desperation is not the best seedbed, the best fertile ground for growth in real conversion. What is curious persistence. That's the fertile soil where real and deep and lasting conversion takes place, where real new life can be born. Look, in my life, I have had moments when I've had powerful emotional experiences with God. At church sometimes, but often at camps or retreats when I get away in places, in prayer meetings. I've had those moments where I have felt God's presence in intense and palpable ways. And then there have been times in my life when I have chased after that feeling. I wanted that feeling desperately to reproduce it, to replicate it, to make it happen because it would help me feel confident in following Jesus. I just wanted to reproduce that moment, that dramatic rescue me from the back of a van feeling, that rush. I've had times where I've chased that and chased that and chased that because I was desperate for something, some sense that God really was there. And that desperation to feel God that way can lead you down some dark roads into some tragic mistakes even, where you're going to grab hold of anything and say, oh, this is God. Right? You can encounter God in deep and emotional ways, but in my experience, in my life, it's far better to desire to know God. I just want to know him. And then whatever the timing, sometimes those experiences will be emotional and I'll start shouting or whatever. And most of the time, those things are a steady transformation happening in me, a slow growth. Sometimes it's dramatic, like being rescued from a van. Other times it's slow growth. And when I look back on my life at the times when I have truly grown spiritually and converted, it's been those times when I've been curious and persistent. When I refuse to let other people wall me away from Jesus. When I'm willing to climb trees and swim oceans or even read a book to know more about Jesus. Those are the times when I grow deeply and powerfully and truly. And I pair those together with those moments of those experiences with God that are emotional, when God reveals himself to me, that ways that go beyond my intellect and my ability to comprehend. And when I put those together, I have that seedbed of ongoing conversion in my life, in your life. If you only pursue God when you're desperate, your relationship with God is just going to look like a crazy roller coaster. Ups and downs and ins and outs. You won't experience true and lasting transformation. You may experience moments where you get a breakthrough, you glimpse through a crowd of stuff, but then you're right back sucked out of that and on the outside. It's up and down, up and down. You'll never penetrate the crowd that walls you out and have Jesus in your home until curiously and persistently pursue him the way Zacchaeus did. Because conversion is necessary. We must be transformed. And the best circumstances that lead to this conversion happening in our lives is persistent curiosity that we pursue Jesus. And what then is the key? How is Zacchaeus saved? What is at the heart of this salvation, the key to conversion? Is Christianity a path or is it a destination? What do you think as you think about that? Is the Christian faith a path or a destination? If you look at the other religions of the world, most of them talk about what they believe as being a path. You've got to get on this path. You've got to walk this path. You've got to do these things, and then you'll live. Then you'll get salvation. Salvation is this process of keeping traditions, performing rituals, certain practices, and you're never finished. You've got to keep going because you can never be sure. So you've got to keep going all the way until the point you die, and then maybe even after you die, you're going to have to make up for some stuff. Or they're about a destination of just, I got to get my mind into a place where I can disconnect from this body and this world. And once I'm there, I'm in this place. What is Christianity, a path or a destination? How many of you have friends who are atheists or agnostics? We all probably should. How many of you hate raising your hand for things? I should always ask that first. All right, we've got friends who do not believe or just don't know what to think, right? How many of you based on your life, what would they say that Christianity is? Would they say it's based on your life and what they know of you? Would they say it's a path or a destination or something else? You know, ask your Christian friends or ask your non-Christian friends, what does it mean to be a Christian? And what most people will say, Christian or not, is that, well, you know, faith in Jesus means I know he's there for me when I'm going through hard times. Like, he's the life preserver when I'm desperate. And, you know, I know he helps me to be good and do what's right and stay on the path. And that one day, if I do that and stay on the path and he helps me out in the times when I'm desperate, then I'll get to go to heaven. A lot of the way we talk indicates we see salvation as this path to a place. But is that really the key of salvation, the key of conversion? Is that the heart of what we believe? Is that the key to transforming faith in Jesus? Turn to Jesus when things are tough. Try to do what's right and follow him and stay on the path, and then you'll get into heaven. What do we learn from Zechariah's encounter? Zacchaeus. I knew I would do that. What does Jesus say to Zacchaeus? So look verse 5 and look at verse 9. Look at what Jesus says in verse 5 and verse 9. Just flip back and forth between those here on the screen. Verse 9, go back, verse 5. Verse 5 and verse 9. I must stay at your house today. Today, salvation has come to this house. You see it? What came to Zacchaeus' house that day? Salvation. Who came to Zacchaeus' house that day? Jesus. Salvation is not a path. Salvation is not a destination. It is a person. It is Jesus. Where Jesus is present, there is salvation. Jesus isn't the way to salvation. He is the salvation itself. He is more than just the way. You don't do this or that and get salvation. You embrace him, and in him, you are saved. It's not about staying on a path so that you get to a destination. It's about Jesus. It's about knowing him, loving him, being united to him. Jesus is the key, the heart of salvation. So Jesus doesn't say, Zacchaeus, you're a mess. I mean, look at you. You're corrupt, you're dishonest, you're a thief. You betrayed your own people, and you betrayed God. You don't lean on me when things are tough. You don't follow the path. Go clean up your life so I can come into your house and bless you. That's not what Jesus says. He says, I'm coming to your house. Let's go. I am salvation. And understand something about the culture they're in. To invite someone to dinner is to accept them, to accept an offer to dinner is an act of open friendship. It is an act of open friendship. It's not just dinner. It's a commitment to friendship. Jesus makes the commitment to love and befriend Zacchaeus before Zacchaeus is lovable, while he is still the traitor who is robbing people blind. You see that? Right there is the key difference between Christianity and every other conception about God that humanity has come up with in our collective, desperate search to understand what powerful force stands behind all these things. The difference is the order of things. God is not angrily waiting for us to come to him with our tail between our legs, and then he'll love us. He's not waiting for us to walk a certain path and get things cleaned up, and then we get to him. God came to us. And that is revolutionary, and it should convert you. Hearing that should never get old. Every time you hear it, something should leap in your heart and say, oh my God, he came to me. How many times, husbands and wives, fathers and mothers, have you sat there and said about your child or your spouse or your friend, well, they're the one who did something wrong. They should come to me. And you sit there and you wait, and you wait, and you wait until they come to you. Because they're the one who did something wrong. They need to come to you. Our Creator came running to us. So why do I live the Christian life? Because Jesus came to me, to my home, and converted my life. That's why I live the way I live. He did what he did and converted me. Not so that I can get to heaven and see God and my family and friends one day. No, I live the way I live. I walk this walk because Jesus came to me. And when I met Jesus, he converted me. That's why we live the way we live. Look at how Zacchaeus then responds in verse 8. He experiences this conversion of his life, and this incredible transformation takes place where he goes from thieving to generous. Why? Not to please Jesus, to convince Jesus to come to his home. No, because Jesus came to his home as a response to Jesus loving him. Zacchaeus does these things. Even though it cost Jesus so much, Jesus came to Zacchaeus' house. Did you see the cost in all that? Did you notice? Zacchaeus noticed how much it cost Jesus to come to his home. Did you see it there? Luke wants us to see it, so he points it out. He just says something brief, but it's so that we'll notice that this really cost Jesus something even there. Look at verse 7. All the people saw this, Jesus going to Zacchaeus' house, and they began to mutter, which means to grumble and to complain and talk behind his back, to gossip. They all went to Twitter and started saying, "Oh, we thought Jesus was good. He's going to Zacchaeus' house. He's as bad a traitor as Zacchaeus is." They began to mutter about Jesus. How can he possibly go to this home of this sinner? The crowd that hated Zacchaeus and was against Zacchaeus now turns against Jesus. And that's what Luke wants us to see. Jesus endured the disdain of the crowd in order to love Zacchaeus, who was unlovely, unlovable. Because that's what our God is like. How much more should we love Jesus? Zacchaeus doesn't even know yet what Jesus is going to do, why Jesus is passing through his town. Do you know why Jesus is passing through Zacchaeus' town that day? He's on his way to Jerusalem to get killed for you and me. That's why he's there. Zacchaeus doesn't know that Jesus is going to do that. He just knows that Jesus came to his home and loved him at cost to himself, cost of his reputation and the people's opinion. And Zacchaeus converts. How much more should you and I, knowing what Jesus has done for us, be astounded and experience this converting transformation? Because we know everything Jesus did, how he emptied himself and died for us. And that's the gospel. This is the key to conversion. You see God's grace, it breaks through your heart and your blindness, and it fills you with a life, and you are radically changed from that day on. Sometimes it happens in sudden, quick, and dramatic ways. Your life goes from degenerate traitor to people to super generous person. And sometimes it's slow. Some things about your life will change instantaneously. Other things, slow growth. But whatever it is, it's always going to be the result of encountering Jesus. He is salvation. It's always a response to Jesus because he's the salvation that sets us out on a path that is him to a destination that is also him. It's all about Jesus. Conversion is necessary. When you encounter Jesus, you will be transformed. And the fertile soil where that happens is a curious and persistent heart. And the key to that conversion is Jesus. Salvation isn't a path or a destination alone. It is Jesus. And lastly, what's the sign? The sign that you and I, that have been and are being converted. Verse 8, Zacchaeus stands up and says to the Lord, "Look, Lord, here and now I give half of everything I own, half of my possessions to the poor. And if I've cheated anybody out of anything, I'll pay back four times the amount I cheated them for." Meeting Jesus converts you, and conversion changes your view of wealth and power and makes you want to give them away in radical ways. Radical generosity is the sign that we have been converted. You know, we talked last week about the standard of giving 10% of our income every year, the tithe. And many people say that doesn't apply to us anymore because it's not really emphasized in the New Testament. We mentioned that. And as if there were, you know, two faiths, one in the Old Testament, one in the New Testament, as if there was a faith that, you know, there's a dividing line between Malachi and Matthew. But there's not. So you go to Matthew chapter 23, verse 23, and you see Jesus say, or Luke 11, you see Jesus say, talking to the Pharisees, who were very good about giving their money and paying their tithe, but they weren't radically generous. And so Jesus says to them, "Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites. You give a tenth, not just of their money, like they give a tenth of their spices." So it's like, okay, go to your spice rack when you get home and take a tenth of your spices. That's how strict and fastidious these guys were about tithing, right? Jesus says, you give a tenth of all your stuff, but you've neglected the more important matters of the law, justice, mercy, faithfulness. And a lot of people end there and say, oh, well, okay, that stuff's more important than being generous with money. It's more important to have justice, mercy, and faithfulness. And we end it there, and we don't listen to the rest of what Jesus said. But what Jesus says next is this. You should have practiced the latter. You should have tithed without neglecting the former. You should have practiced justice, mercy, and faithfulness without neglecting tithing. You shouldn't just be generous with your money. You should be radically generous in every area of your life. That's what Jesus is saying. It's right and good that you're being financially generous by tithing. You should do that, but I want you to be radically generous. That's what being like God is like. Be radically generous. Go way beyond this and become generous in every area of your life. And Zacchaeus is a great example of this for you and for me. Because look at how he responds to Jesus coming to his home. Look at how he responds to this conversion that happens in him with this radical generosity where he gives away not only his wealth, but his power. There is a connection between wealth and power. And I want to show you what I mean. So stick with me here. He doesn't just give away 10% of his wealth. How much does he give away? Half. Half. 50% he gives away right there that day. And then Mosaic law required that if you ever cheated someone, you needed to pay them back what you cheated them of plus 20%. So if you cheated someone out of $100, you'd pay them back, math people, $120, right? How much does Zacchaeus pay back after being converted by Jesus? 400%. And what does this mean for you and me? Seeing his conversion, the way he responds, what does this mean for you and me? It means that this is the way a converted heart looks at money. It doesn't ask, all right, how much do I have to give? It asks, how much can I give? He blows all the requirements out of the water. That's what Jesus does. That's what Zacchaeus then did. Blows all the requirements, not even about requirements anymore. Everything intensifies with Jesus. So go back and look at his Sermon on the Mount. Not only do I not murder, now I don't allow myself to be angry at a brother. Not only do I not commit adultery, I run away from lust. Not only do I not only do I keep my oaths that are solemn oaths, I don't lie anymore. Not only do I love my friends, I love my enemies. Everything with Jesus intensifies, so the tithing becomes the floor instead of the ceiling. Everything intensifies. The second thing this teaches us is that a converted heart isn't just generous with its wealth, it's generous with its power. And here's how those are connected. The more money you have, the more of the world you own, right? The more freedoms you have to do what you want to do, the more control you have, you get to choose your education, you get to choose your doctors, choose where you live, how you live, what you eat, where you go out for fun. More money, more power. Less money, less power, less control. The very first week, we quoted Warren Buffett. And we talked about how he had given about $30 billion to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. But do you remember what he said about his gift and about his giving? Let me remind you. He said, "My gift has not changed my lifestyle one bit. I still go to the movies I want to go to and eat at the restaurants I want to dine at. But what about the person who gives a gift that requires they can't go to the movies or eat out? They're the true givers, the true heroes of generosity." Because Warren Buffett recognized that radical generosity involves giving away your power. He'd given away a lot of money, but he hadn't given away his power. When you're generous to the point that it affects your lifestyle, where you're sacrificing your standard of living and the freedom that money could give you, you're now beginning to give away your power. And for most of us, many of us, 10% would do that, right? Giving away 10% of our wealth every year would certainly impact our power in this world. And I'm well aware that for some of you, you know, we're talking about 10% of nothing, right? Some of you are sitting here and you have nothing. And that's why Jesus commended that woman. Do you remember the story of the woman with the two mites giving? She gave those two little mites, all right? And Jesus says, recognizes her for giving more of her power and wealth than all the Pharisees around her who were giving thousands and thousands and thousands. Because Jesus isn't trying to establish a new law to bash us over the head with. He's trying to establish a new freedom. that will set us free from the captivity to wealth because it has kidnapped our hearts. He's teaching us to rely on him and to rely on each other. And look, if we are not a church that cares for the poor and the destitute, it doesn't matter if every one of us is giving 10% of our wealth or 50% of our wealth every year. But if we all would be radically generous, we'd be able to care for the poor among us, those who are going through difficult times. We'd be able to invest more in ministry, pay off mortgages, do the things we need to do if we would allow Jesus to convert us completely and wholly to the point where we even give away our power. The 10% would represent giving away power for most of us in this room. But for those who are wealthy like Zacchaeus, you may need to go beyond 10%. Maybe way beyond 10% before you get to the point where you're actually being generous with your power and it's impacting your life. Where you leave the Warren Buffett category of generosity, because it doesn't matter the amount, but you recognize what he recognized. That radical generosity is giving to the point where I'm giving away my power. And that's the point where you and I really are learning to trust God. I know in my heart it's a trust issue. But God, if I don't, but God, then I won't. But then I, how am I, do I trust him? Did he come to my home? Has a new life been born in me that has set me free from being a prisoner of these things that pick me up and throw me in their van and drive me off? So that I can be free to love him and experience the wealth that he gives. Because when we understand what Jesus did for us, what seems impossible, what makes us all deadly silent in this room right now, a joy takes over us when we recognize what Jesus did. The way a good father is happily generous for the sake of his children, happy to have his sanity, his serenity, his cleanliness, his power, his wealth all taken from him because of his children. That's what our Father has done for us. Because you realize the power of money and wealth are a false power. They do not buy you the family you want or the security you want or the future you want. But Jesus has done that for you and for me. He came to your house, even though it cost him all of his power. He emptied himself. Emptied himself, 100%. It cost him all of his power in order to give you and to give me a wealth and a power that's unlike anything in this world. John 1:12, this is the gospel, he says, to all who receive him, to all who believe in Jesus' name, Jesus gives power to become sons and daughters of God. Jesus gave up all his power so that you and I could have a new power that goes far beyond anything else in this world. Any power your wealth will get you. He wants to give you and I the power of being sons and daughters of God. I want that power. I want to only want that power. And I pray for you this morning that we would all want that power. Let's bow our heads. Father, I pray not just that we would want the power of being your sons and your daughters, but that wanting that power would be the only thing we want. And God, I pray that we would find it in you, that we would pursue you. God, that we would get past immature and childish ideas, and that we'd grab hold of the meat of your word. God, that we wouldn't think we can be a little bit your follower, a little bit like Jesus, many Christians, Jesus. I pray that we would grab hold of this revolutionary truth that you want to give birth to something inside of us, and when birth is given, everything changes. And that is good, and that is awesome, and it sets us free. And God, some of us right now are chained up in the back of vans, and we need a dramatic rescue. And God, I pray that we would embrace your rescue. And Lord, I pray that you would plant in our hearts this curious persistence that'll keep us pressing for you, Lord God. Not to prove anything to you because there's nothing we could prove. Not to earn anything from you because there's nothing we could earn. But just to have you, Jesus. just to encounter you, Jesus. And for those of us who've encountered you, I pray that we would be converted and transformed, and that we'd bear these signs by being radically generous in every aspect of our lives. God, I pray you would do that in my heart. Do that in our hearts as a church, I pray. In Jesus' name, amen.